Well, good evening. It's very good to be here with you for Bible study. Seems like it's been a long time, but I guess it's just been the normal length of time, but maybe it's because there's been so much packed in and so many people and places between those times. This evening, we are covering, continuing our survey through the Gospels. The lesson this evening covers the time between right before Passover in 30 A.D., up to the time just before the fall festival season of 38 days, so approximately a six-month period. Now, during this time, Jesus remained in the area of primarily of Galilee, entirely outside of the area of Jerusalem and Judea, as we'll see going through there. It's interesting as we progress through the Gospels, we find that as we move toward the conclusion of Christ's life and ministry, more and more detail is given. And so we're covering this evening about a six-month period, and then we'll cover less than that next time as we find more detail given. One of the areas that we find that is mentioned in here in Scripture, this section is the area that talks about where Christ described that he would build his church, and this is in the context, we'll primarily go through it in Matthew's account, Matthew 16, where Christ talks about, I'll build my church and the gates of hell, of Hades, won't prevail against it. This was in the aftermath of Peter's confession of faith. Now, it's sort of interesting because as you put the story together, the actual geographic location where Christ talked about upon this rock, I'll build my church, and there's sort of a play on words that is given in terms of the terms for rock. Well, it's interesting because the geographic location was the area of Caesarea Philippi, and it was a very fitting place for Christ to describe this because when you look at the geography of the area, just prior to entering Caesarea Philippi, there's a huge cliff that dominates the scene. And at the base of the cliff, during the time of Christ, a major spring gushed out from under the cliff, and it was one of the sources of the Jordan River. Flowed into the Jordan was one of the sources. Now, you stop and you think about that. Here's this massive cliff, and here at the base is this stream of pure water that's gushing out, that goes on down and goes into the Jordan River and becomes one of the sources. Christ then starts talking about upon this rock. Everybody's looking. Here's a huge rock. The rock is symbolic of him. Now, what is it that, what is pure water the symbol of? Pure flowing water. That's used over and over in Scriptures as a symbol of God's Holy Spirit. Now, here the water, just think about it, the water came gushing out of this huge boulder, this huge cliff, rock there on the this hillside, and it flowed down in a stream, and as it flowed, it was flowing over all sorts of little rocks. You know, the stream, the area, the setting there was rocky, all sorts of pebbles and rocks. As this water comes gushing out of the base of the cliff and comes flowing down through that. Now, you know, a lot of analogies we can get. Peter describes later, you know, Peter had this in his mind for a long time because, after all, Christ gave him the nickname of rock, you know, little rock, Petros. There's sort of a play on words in the Greek, Petra and Petros. One is used to refer to a large rock and the other to a small rock. Peter talks about in 1 Peter that we're all living stones being built up. You know, Peter developed that, and how Jesus Christ is the chief cornerstone. He's the big rock. We're all living stones being set in. So, anyway, sort of an interesting, this was a very graphic setting to illustrate a lasting lesson to Peter and the rest of the apostles. It's interesting, you know, sometimes Christ took advantage of a circumstance, drew a certain picture with words that was reinforced even by the natural setting in which they were, that sort of impressed some of these lessons upon them. Now, it's interesting in the section that we're going through this evening, the event that enables us to set the timing. I said the time is right, starts right before the Feast of Unleavened Bread, right before the Passover season of 30 A.D. Now, you may wonder, well, how is it that we can know for sure that this is right before Passover? The particular account that begins the lesson this evening is one of the few accounts that is actually covered in all four Gospels. Apart from the events of the crucifixion and the resurrection, there is very little that is actually covered in all four Gospels. Matthew, Mark, and Luke will often cover the same thing. John rarely covers what they do. But the account of Jesus feeding the 5,000 is something that is mentioned all four of the Gospel accounts. Now, John is the one who adds in a detail that enables us to date it and therefore to date similar events in the rest of the Gospels. Notice here in John chapter 6, John 6 verse 1. After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, that was the other name for it, and a great multitude followed him because they saw his miracles, which he did on them that were diseased. And Jesus went up into a mountain, and there he sat with his disciples, and the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. So John is the only one who adds in that this event took place just before Passover. Jesus lifted up his eyes, he saw a great company, and he said to Philip, "Where are we going to buy bread that these may eat?" Now this he said to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. You know, sometimes God asks a question. Christ asked a question. In the Old Testament you read of him asking questions to see, give people a chance to answer. You know, like he said, Adam, did you eat of the tree that I told you not to? He already knew. He just wanted to see what Adam would say. He said, Cain, where's your brother? You seen Abel around? Here, you know, sometimes you ask somebody something and you want to see how they'll respond. What are they going to say? What's going to be the response? Philip, he was just sort of testing Philip a little bit. And he said, Philip, don't you think we ought to feed all these people? Where are we going to, how do you think we'll do that? How are we going to provide for all these folks? Well, Philip was just sort of flabbergasted. Verse 7, he says, why? 200 penny worth. A penny, a denarius, was the, let's say, a working man's wage for a day in that period of the first century. So, in effect, what he's saying is two-thirds of a year's wages. If you could go through and to sort of get a feel for it, we're talking the equivalent of several thousand dollars. I mean, you think if you had 5,000 men besides women and children, if you're going to buy everybody a McDonald's Happy Meal, it's going to cost you, several thousand dollars. I mean, you're going to get out, it's going to be close to a year's wages or two-thirds of a year's wages to get out of that. So that's, in effect, what Philip says, where in the world are you going to come up with money like that to feed all of them? Still, we wouldn't, if you spent all that, everyone would only have a little bit. And one of the disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said, the only food I've seen here is a little kid over there, and he's got 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish. And the others must have sort of looked at him, like, what does that have to do with anything? Because notice his next statement, but what are they among so many? He sort of pipes up and volunteers, and then you can just almost imagine the rest of them looking at him like, well, that's a pretty dumb statement. What's that going to do? And, Christ just sort of lets the thing play out. And then he tells him, he says, well, have everybody sit down. And there was a lot of grass in the place, and so the men sat down. There were about 5,000. Took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed to the disciples, and the disciples to them that were sat down, and likewise of the fish as much as they would. And when they were filled, He said to his disciples, "Gather up the fragments that remain, that nothing be lost." They therefore gathered them together and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves that remained. Now, you know, that's pretty dramatic. It's interesting if you go through the parallel accounts, Matthew, Mark, and Luke tie in the fact that this occurred shortly after the beheading of John the Baptist. That's mentioned in Matthew 14. And we get to the account where it describes the mentions in Matthew 14:17, the 5 loaves and 2 fishes, commanded the multitude to sit down, bless them, and they ate and were filled the 12 baskets. So it's the parallel account. Mark 6 and Luke 9 all give parallel accounts. John is the one who enables us to date it. And it's interesting, as you go through here, because, well, notice Mark's account. This is sort of a little minor detail, but I think it gives us a little insight just into the character of Jesus Christ, the kind of person that he was, which, of course, gives us a little insight maybe into some things we ought to do. God's not the author of confusion. Now, he didn't have a big mob scene where everybody was trying to mob the basket with the fish and the bread. Mark brings in the detail that Mark 6:39, he commanded them to make everyone sit down by companies upon the green grass. And they sat down in ranks by hundreds and by fifties. So just sort of, Mark adds in a little detail that none of the others mentioned. Christ had them sit down in an organized way where you broke it up into groups of 50 and 100 and you could get things organized and pass things out. It was, then he passed around the baskets and they collected the fragments. Again, you know, if Christ presided over something when you finished, it didn't look like the Astrodome or something after a ball game where there's food and litter and junk everywhere and it's a major process to come in and clean everything up. He passed the baskets around and collected it. Those maybe are small points, but I think it just gives us a little insight. Christ was organized. He was neat. He didn't just trash the place when he left. He was careful to gather things up. He was not wasteful. That's just the pattern of his character. You say, well, you know, he could have wasted it. He could have just created more. Well, yeah, it wasn't that he didn't waste it because he was afraid he'd run out. He didn't waste it because that's just not a good principle of character, to be wasteful. Sometimes some of these little minor things, you know, minor in the overall scope, of that's not the primary emphasis of the story, but it does... It's good as we read through to pick out some of those little things just to gain insight into the kind of person Jesus Christ was and how he did things. And, think about that sometimes. You go in on the road, you know, you stop and you go into a public restroom and it's like you got paper towels scattered all over the place and water splattered all over the sink and it's just, you know, just a mess. And I have thought about sometimes, you know, if you went in to a place like that after Jesus Christ, it wouldn't look like that. I mean, he wouldn't leave the place looking a mess. You drive down some of the beautiful highways and you look at, you know, trash on the side of the road. Just somebody didn't want to go to the trouble of putting it in the trash can when they stopped for gas. They'd throw it out the window. That is just a principle of character. But anyway, John dates it. Matthew, Mark, and Luke cover the same thing. Now, one of the things that we will notice. Let's come on through John's account a little further, and then we'll come back to Matthew and sort of work our way through. John has gone through this account of the miracle of the loaves and the fishes. Now, John chapter 6, verse 13, they gathered up the fragments. Verse 14, then those men, when they had seen the miracle that Jesus did, said, "This is of a truth that prophet that should come into the world." So people were really impressed. And they said, well, he must be the one that is spoken of in Deuteronomy 17. And you know, that prophet, by the way, is an expression that is used back in Deuteronomy. It refers to Jesus Christ. Does not refer to Gerald Fleury, despite his claims to the contrary. Mr. Armstrong was the Elijah, and he is that prophet. Well, no, he's not. But people here were a little more perceptive. They said, pointing to Jesus Christ, maybe he is that prophet, the one that was spoken of, prophesied in Deuteronomy, you know, that Moses said, the Lord your God shall raise up unto you a prophet like unto me. And there are other references that talk about that prophet. Well, they understood that, and they were impressed. And Jesus, verse 15, perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king. You know, you could just see this big mob scene. He knew what was going on in their mind, so he just sort of went off into the mountain himself. And when evening was come, his disciples went down to the sea, and they entered into a ship and went over the sea toward Capernaum. And it was now dark, and Jesus was not come. Now, if you go back to your Bible, if you have a Bible map, I had passed out one. You find that Capernaum, Christ was on the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and the disciples crossed over to Capernaum, which is, let's say, on the northwest side, sort of the north shore, western shore of the Sea of Galilee. Christ had gone up in the mountain. Other accounts show, he went to get away from the crowd. He went to pray. And he had, again, when you put the other accounts, because all the gospel accounts mention this, that Christ had told them, in effect, to go without him. So it got dark, and Jesus wasn't come. And so they had gone ahead to cross the lake in the boat, and a storm began to come up. And again, as the other accounts bring out, they had a very frightening experience, because here they were Matthew, let's just hold your spot there. Let's come back and just briefly look. Matthew adds in a couple of very important details. And in Matthew 14, verse 24, the ship was now in the midst of the sea, tossed with waves, the wind was contrary. In the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went unto them walking on the water. This is in the wee hours of the morning. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled. Scared them half to death. You can just imagine. They're out here in a boat in the middle of the water, and a storm is throwing the thing. And here are experienced sailors. I mean, these aren't guys who are unfamiliar with boats. A number of them had made their living as professional fishermen on the Sea of Galilee. So if it was a storm that was bad enough that they had trouble getting across, you know it was bad. And they were already worried and out here in this stormy weather, and to look up, you know, it's pitch black, but if it's stormy, you must have lightning flashes, and all of a sudden you see somebody walking on the water. Well, that was, if you weren't scared beforehand, you'd be scared now. You know, they thought they were seeing some sort of a spirit or an apparition, and they cried out for fear. God save us, what is this? And next thing you know, verse 27, Jesus spoke unto them, and he said, "Be of good cheer. It's me. Don't be afraid. What are you scared of?" And Peter said, Lord, if it's you, why don't you tell me to come out there and come to meet you? And he says, well, come on. And Peter came down out of the ship and he walked on the water to go to Jesus. Verse 30, but when he saw the wind boisterous, he was afraid, beginning to sink. He cried, saying, Lord, save me. Immediately Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him and said, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? When they came into the ship, the wind ceased. And they that were in the ship came and worshipped him, saying, of a truth, you are the Son of God. I mean, it's, you know, just an overwhelming experience. Now, you know, sometimes we read the account and say, well, you know, Peter sure didn't have much faith. Well, he took more steps on the water than anybody in this room has ever taken on the water, right? He took more than any of the rest of them. You know, Peter was fine as long as he kept his eyes on Christ. And we're usually doing pretty good as long as we keep our eyes on Him. But the minute Peter started looking around, then all of a sudden what he was doing, he thought, I can't do this. I mean, you know, he was looking at Christ and Christ was doing it and he said, come on. And Peter said, okay. He just jumped out and he took a few steps and then all of a sudden, you know, maybe the lightning flashed or the thunder rolled and he looked and he's on water and there are waves and boy, he just began to sink in a hurry. His faith began to go down the drain. And that's sort of the way we are, you know. We find ourselves sometimes in situations and about the time we start looking at the around, then we get scared. And if you focus on the around, fear will replace faith. If you focus on God, faith will replace fear. Pretty simple equation. Now, this was a very dramatic event. Now, the disciples had just gotten through seeing a tremendous miracle. I mean, they saw, you know, they saw the five loaves and two fishes, and they must have sort of looked at one another and wondered, what in the world is he going to do with this? He has everybody sit down and get organized, tells you guys, you know, see if you can get some baskets. And you know, you can just imagine what must have been going on in their mind. I mean, they were doing it, but they must have thought, what in the world is he going to do? What are we going to do with this little puny amount? And they kept passing it, and when it got to the end of the row, it looked like there was more in there than when they started. And here were people that had food, and they were passing this stuff all around. And then when they went back and they collected the baskets full left over, I mean, it really was a remarkable thing. And then they see this miracle. So they are deeply impressed in a special way. Now, they've seen Jesus Christ work miracle after miracle. They've heard him teach and preach. If we're up to the time of the Passover of 30 A.D., realize he had begun his ministry at the fall, right before the fall festival of 27. So that's 2.5 years that have gone, that have already passed. They've seen a lot of things, but somehow this just really hits them. We're going to come back here to Matthew's account, but let's go back to John John records the details of what came next. You see, it talks about the walking on water. John didn't mention the Peter because that was already in the Gospels. But then what John adds in verse 22, the day followed. When the people which stood on the other side of the sea saw there was no other boat except the one his disciples had entered, and Jesus didn't go with them, but his disciples had gone alone. See, they looked for him. They couldn't find him. Couldn't figure out how he got over there. Because they'd been standing, you know, they watched until the disciples left. And there were some other boats from Tiberias near the place. And when the people saw that Jesus wasn't there, nor his disciples, they took shipping and came to Capernaum seeking him. And when they found him on the other side of the sea, first question they said was, Rabbi, how did you get over here? Well, we thought we were keeping a good eye out. You didn't catch one of the boats down here, and you didn't go with your disciples. How in the world did you get over here? You know, you don't always have to answer every question that somebody asks you. Jesus didn't. Verse 26, he said, truly I say unto you, you're not looking for me because you saw, not because you saw miracles, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled. He said, I know why you come looking for me. You're hungry. It's lunchtime. And you're ready for a meal. So he just sort of changed the subject, got to the heart of what was important. They didn't need to know that he walked on the water to get across. He didn't feel the need to tell them everything. Then, see, he goes right into a subject. He says, don't spend all your effort and energy laboring for food that perishes, but rather for food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give you. For him is the Father sealed. And they said, what shall we do that we might work the works of God? And Jesus answered and said unto them, this is the work of God, that you believe on him whom he sent. And they said, well, what sign are you going to show us that we may see and believe you? What are you going to do? Our fathers ate manna in the desert. You know, it's written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat. See, they already had in mind what they'd like for him to do again. Why don't you make another meal, you know? Moses, if you're that prophet, like unto Moses, well, Moses fed them, he fed them every day for 40 years. What are you going to do today? And Jesus said, look, Moses didn't give you the bread from heaven. My Father gives you the true bread from heaven. The bread of God is he which comes down from heaven and gives life unto the world. And they said, well, Lord, give us this bread. And Jesus said unto them, I am the bread of life. He that comes to me shall never hunger. He that believes on me shall never thirst. He says in verse 38, I didn't come down from heaven to do my own will, but the will of him that sent me. This is the Father's will, which has sent me, that all that of all which he's given me I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again at the last day. And the Jews began to murmur because he had said, verse 41, I'm the bread that comes down from heaven. And they said, well, we know who this guy is. This is Jesus, the son of Joseph. We know his parents. How does he say I came down from heaven? So Jesus knew what they were doing. He says, don't murmur. No man can come to me except the Father which has sent me draw him. And then he begins to come on down in more detail. Verse 59, these sayings said he in the synagogue as he taught in Capernaum. Now, when did this miracle occur? Right before the Passover, right? Jesus crossed over. And the next thing you find, he's got a crowd and he's teaching them at the synagogue in Capernaum. And what is he doing? Well, this miracle of the loaves and the fishes, needless to say, when all this bunch of people, I mean, there are several thousand people that evidently crossed the sea and came into Capernaum. Well, this created quite a stir in Capernaum. Here's this whole crowd of people coming across, and they're looking for Jesus. And you can believe they began to tell everybody, oh man, yeah, you should have been over there yesterday. Why, he performed this miracle. Why, we had all this food. And they looked him up. So bread was on everyone's mind. And it was right here at Passover time. In fact, when he taught in the synagogue in Capernaum, verse 59, that's probably on the first holy day of unleavened bread. So it would have been on the Sabbath or a holy day, and I think the timing of it, because what is he talking about? I'm the bread of life, verse 48. Verse 50, this is the bread that comes down from heaven, that a man may eat thereof and not die. I'm the living bread which comes down from heaven. Jesus talked about eating his flesh and drinking his blood. Verse 57, as the living Father has sent me, and as I live by the Father, so he that eats me, even he shall live by me. This is the bread that comes down from heaven. This is what he was teaching in the synagogue in Capernaum. He was talking about bread. It was right at the time, the beginning of the days of unleavened bread. John is the one who always adds in, you see, records the details of what Jesus actually taught on the festival. Matthew, Mark, and Luke did not address this part of the matter. And so we find this account that is given here, and a lot of insight as Christ began to explain the spiritual significance of unleavened bread. When he said, I'm the bread of life. You know, he's an analogy that Christ is our source of spiritual nourishment. We ingest the broken bread at Passover, but we, for 7 days following, eat of unleavened bread. And so through our whole focus through that festival is on bread. And what we need to avoid and what we need to be eating. Well, you know, that's to teach us something about life, that we are to be focused on the bread of life, on Jesus Christ, that we're to be our whole focus throughout the entirety of our life needs to be on Jesus Christ and on in that sense feeding on Christ, as he describes here in John chapter 6. And you see, as you run through the account coming up to the end of John 6, where we find Peter's confession and the details of that are given here. We'll read it in Matthew and Mark, but where Peter confessed, "We believe you are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God." John chapter 7, verse 1, "After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee," wouldn't walk in jewelry. Verse 2, "The Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand." So you see, the account that we read here brings us up to, covers this 6-month period, from the Passover 30 on up to the Passover, or to the feast, just 4 days of Feast of Tabernacles there in 30. We read over, I didn't make comment, in John 6:44, where Christ emphasized that the only ones who can truly come to Christ are the ones that the Father draws. You know, God has to draw us. You and I understand the truth because God opened our minds. God called us. The let's go back. Let's before we go to Matthew's account, let's go back to Mark chapter 6 and 7. Mark 6, of course, we already saw the latter part of Mark 6 covers the loaves and the fishes and Peter walking on the water. And we find that Mark 6:51, "He went up unto them into the ship. The wind ceased. They were sore amazed. They considered not the miracle of the loaves. Their heart was hardened." Now, you know, you think about that. That's an incredible thing. I mean, they just gotten through seeing one miracle, and yet they were so overwhelmed by this one. It's like, well, don't you fellows connect the dots and realize that, you know, what he can do? Well, he came into the ship. And word got out. When they came out of the ship, you know, word got out and people were coming to be healed. Now, chapter 7, verse 1 tells us that a number of the Pharisees and certain of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem came. And they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled, that is to say, unwashed hands, and they found fault. The Pharisees had this big focus on outward ceremony. In their mind, defilement was something you contracted by, you know, getting close to somebody who had who was a sinner, someone who had you know, come across, who touched something that was defiled. And they had all of these traditions. And Christ emphasized the fact that the Pharisees were hypocrites. He said in verse 6 of Mark 7, "Well, as Isaiah prophesied of you hypocrites, as it is written, this people honors me with their lips, their heart is far from me. Howbeit in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. You lay aside the commandments of God and hold the tradition of men." Verse 9, "Full well you reject the commandment of God that you may keep your own tradition." Their focus was on what they had invented rather than what God had come up with. And Christ indicted them for their hypocrisy, their play acting. Religion was, it was like a game or a play. Christ goes through and he uses the illustration in terms of this matter of Corban. Corban was a term that meant dedicated, and it was, it had become a means by which people sought to avoid carrying out their duty and their obligation for an elderly, needy parent. They would claim that something was dedicated to the temple. They would pledge it to the temple. They didn't give it to the temple. They kept it. But it's like, well, when I die, this is dedicated to the temple. This is set aside for the temple. I've made a vow to God. I'm going to, you know, leave this to the temple. Well, then they would turn around and, in effect, tell their parents, well, you know, I sure'd like to help you, but I can't. You know, this that I have here, well, I've already promised that to the temple. I can't give it away to you. So they had come up with a sort of a, like a little legal technicality in their minds that they could apply and get around this. You know, God is not impressed by people's technicality. And when somebody thinks they've sort of come up with something to get around. Remember one time, fellow, you know, it's interesting. I mean, some of these attitudes that the Jews have carried down. One fellow who used to call on the college, he was a Jewish salesman, and he was talking, I guess it was the fall was coming up, and, you know, festivals, and he knew that we kept Yom Kippur, you know, the Day of Atonement, the other holy days. And he got talking with somebody. He says, well, he says, you know, the way I get around the Day of Atonement, there's your problem right there. The way I get around it, he says, you know, if you're taking a shower and you're just sort of turning around there under the shower and you know, water gets in your mouth, well, you know, that's not really like going and eating and drinking, it was sort of a, you know, it was a mindset. I think I read you the little clipping back around Passover time that had come up of how you could, sell all your leavening. You know, you could even do it online. They had all of this stuff. Well, it's that sort of mindset. You see that as to how can you get around it having to cost you something. Well, that was the Pharisees' attitude. And they wanted to make an outward show that they were very observant of the law, but they kept looking for loopholes, kept looking for ways that they were not trying to understand what is the spirit and intent. You know, I can remember over the years, from time to time, I've had people who would come to me with a question about, you know, what would happen if I do such and such? Would I get kicked out of the church if I did this or that? It's like, you know, it's the wrong question. It's a whole wrong approach to the issue, because what we need to be seeking for is what would be the most pleasing to God. See, that's the question somebody ought to ask, because I'm faced with a dilemma, and what I'm searching for is to know what action would God be most pleased with, rather than, I want to sort of weigh my options. I got in mind to do this, and if I don't get in too much trouble, oh, only suspended for 3 weeks. Okay, well, that won't be a big deal. I'll be able to come back in time for the feast. Okay, I'll go ahead and do it. I mean, that sort of, you can almost read the thinking, see, sort of weighing out the options. Well, you know, people can play games with other people, but we can't play games with God. And that's what Christ was indicting the Pharisees for, a whole way of thinking, their whole approach. It wasn't just, you know, it's not that there's anything wrong with washing your hands, but their whole approach to life was they missed the spirit and intent. They weren't searching for the spirit of the law. And that's what Christ always emphasized. See, what is it that God is after? What does God really want? Because if we have the mind of Christ, then what we're searching for is, what does God really want? So he told them in verse 13 of Mark 7, he says, you make the word of God of none effect through your tradition, which you've delivered, and many such things you do. Then he called the people over, and he said, there, verse 15, there's nothing from without a man that entering in can defile him. The things which come out of him, those are the things that defile him. And the disciples, a little later, they said, what exactly you mean by that? In verse 18, he said, "Are you without understanding also? You don't understand that whatever from without entering in can't defile a person?" Verse 19, because it doesn't enter into his heart. That's where your relationship with God is based on your mind, your thinking, your emotions, your all of the thoughts and intents of your heart and mind. Not something that goes into your stomach. You know, those stuff that you touch something with your hands and put it in your mouth, that goes into the belly and goes out into the draught, purging all meats. In other words, it just goes through the system, it goes through your digestive system, and it's eliminated. It's that which comes out of a man, that defiles a man. Because within, out of the heart of men, proceeds evil thoughts, adulteries, fornication, murder, theft, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. These things come from within. That's what defiles. You know, thoughts, attitudes, intentions. All of the things that originate deep inside of our thinking. You know, some try to twist this as though, well, you know, this is where Christ cleansed all the meats. Well, number one, the word meat in the King James is just a word that means food. In fact, when you read of the so-called meat offerings back in the Old Testament, that's the only offerings that weren't meat. Meat was used in the older English sense. Meat just meant food. Specifically, what was called the meat offerings were grain, not flesh. Meat just simply refers to food. And the issue, the whole context, the issue has nothing whatsoever to do with clean and unclean. It has to do with the ceremony of washing of the hands and of whether certain things are ceremonially defiled because you had been in the marketplace and you may have brushed up against somebody and you came home and you didn't go through this ritual and you put something in your mouth and now you've been contaminated. One other thing, just a very simple place to go, what about in Acts 10, Peter's vision? You remember what Peter said after he saw the sheet coming down three times? "Not so, Lord. I have never eaten anything common or unclean." And then when he woke up, he puzzled within himself as to what the vision would mean. If Christ cleansed all meat here, this is a year before his crucifixion. Don't you think, you know, if Peter would have noticed it if Christ was going around eating ham and shrimp and crawfish and all this stuff? Don't you think Peter would have noticed? There was nothing Jesus had ever said or done that made Peter think that he was supposed to eat unclean food. So when he had this vision, he didn't know what it meant. He knew that it didn't mean he was supposed to start eating this stuff. He says, "I've never done that." He had been with Jesus Christ 3.5 years. And Christ had never done it. Peter had never partaken of anything like that. It just, you know, it's a matter of taking a verse out of context, which when you go through the context, it's not discussing clean and unclean meats at all. That wasn't an issue. The whole audience was Jewish and wasn't some great dispute about whether you can have a ham sandwich or not. The issue was the washing of hands. And Christ is explaining real defilement. You see, what is it that separates you from God? God doesn't dwell in the midst of uncleanness. And so defilement, if I'm defiled, that means I'm dirty, I'm sullied. And I can't come into the presence of God. There were ceremonies that were to emphasize this. The priests, before they could enter into the holy place, before they could approach the altar, they washed their hands and their feet. Aaron had to put on, you know, clean garments before going into the holy place. It was to emphasize that you're coming into the presence of God and you have to be clean. The primary emphasis wasn't simply that you take a shower and put on a clean shirt. It was to emphasize a spiritual lesson. Now, the Pharisees had taken the rituals of the temple, had sought to sort of one-up them by applying them to the dinner table, which was not what they did in context. It was ceremonies of the temple that were to have to do with worship. But the Pharisees thought that they could outrighteous the Sadducees, and so they took all the temple rituals and tried to adapt them for themselves. And in the process, they missed the whole point of what God was after. They'd go through this elaborate washing ceremony and then go down and evict some poor little widow who had fallen behind, you know, and here they were gobbling up houses. You know, Christ told them, he says, "You devour widows' houses and make long prayers for a pretense. You're out, trying to beat some poor old person out of their home so that you can make a quick buck. You have no concept of God's attitude, God's love and righteousness and mercy and all of the things that characterize God's nature. So as we come on down, Christ has just finished dealing with these people who are all filled up with pride. And he left, and the very next thing Mark tells us, he went to the borders of Tyre and Sidon and went to a place there. Evidently he was going to somebody's house and didn't want word to get out. But a certain woman had a young daughter that had an unclean spirit, and she heard of him and came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek or a Gentile, technically a Syrophoenician. She was a Canaanite. And she besought him that he would cast forth the devil out of her daughter, the demon. And Jesus looked at her, and of course we don't have the whole conversation, we just got part of it. Jesus looked over and he says, don't you think the children ought to be filled first? It's not fitting to take the children's food and throw it to the puppies under the table. There are two terms for dogs, by the way. The term that is used in a derogatory sense in the New Testament refers like to a pack of the little puppies under the table. That's what she said. See, she said, well, yes, Lord, that's right. You wouldn't take the children's food and put it down under the table for the puppies to eat. But on the other hand, they eat the crumbs. And he said unto her, for this saying, go your way. The demon is gone out of your daughter. When she came to her house, she found the demon gone. And her daughter laid upon the bed. Now you can read the parallel accounts. It talks about that back in Matthew 15, and Jesus said, Matthew 15:28, O woman, great is your faith. Be it unto you even as you will. And if you look at Luke's account, and let's see here, and where it brings out, let's see more. Tales. Anyway, the whole point of the thing was Christ noticed her attitude. She had quite a contrast with the Pharisees. You know, they were all filled up with pride and so impressed with themselves and all of this. And here's this woman who evidences great humility. You know, she didn't come in with some arrogant sort of an attitude. And Christ, in effect, was testing her attitude. He had come not to go to the whole world, not to his primary mission was not to go to the Gentiles, though that was ultimately the gospel was going to go everywhere. He came unto his own. He came specifically, in another place he says, I'm not sent but to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But as individuals would approach him. That didn't mean that he wasn't willing to help them individually, but that was not the focus of his mission. But he sort of tested her in terms of her attitude, of what her approach was. And she was an individual of humility and of faith. And did not get all mad and offended and all of this, which ought to tell us something, you know, that an attitude of someone who's quick to get mad, quick to take offense, that's not something that God is pleased with. She had a very humble attitude. Now, we read this account here in Matthew. We'll come on here in Matthew 15. We've come back here. We'll go on through Matthew's account. After this account, verse 29, Jesus departed, came near to the Sea of Galilee, went up to a mountain. And multitudes came to him. And so Jesus told the disciples, verse 32, I have compassion on the multitude. They continue here now 3 days. They have nothing to eat. They evidently brought some food or something, but whatever they brought, they'd run out of. He says, I'm not going to send them away fasting lest they faint. And the disciples said, where are we going to find food for all this bunch in the wilderness? And Jesus said, how many loaves do you have? And they said, well, we got 7 loaves and a few little fish. And he commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground, took 7 loaves and the fish, gave thanks, broke them, gave to his disciples. They did all eat and were filled and took up 7 baskets full. And they that did eat were 4,000 men besides women and children. He sent away the multitude and took the ship and came to the coast of Magdala. This is where Mary Magdalene came from. So this is a second miraculous occasion of feeding people. Occurred in a while, period of weeks after the other. Well, the Pharisees with the Sadducees came tempting him, desiring him that he would show them a sign. And Christ told them in verse 3, you hypocrites, you tell the signs in the sky, but you can't discern the signs of the times. A wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. Only sign you're going to get is the sign of the prophet Jonah. He departed. You realize, in a very special way, the sign of 3 days and three nights in the tomb was a special sign for the religious leaders. Matthew records the event later on that these were the religious leaders who went to Pilate and got a guard to post on the guard of the tomb. So you see, they had an eyewitness account from their hand-picked guards. So they knew when he was put in and they knew when he came out. Sort of interesting. You know, this was a... they wanted a sign, they got one. And they had their own hand-picked witnesses. Christ referred to them as a wicked and adulterous generation. For all of their great pretense about piety and religion, they obviously were not doing everything they should have done. I'd sort of tie this in the account in John, where they brought in the woman taken in adultery in the very act. You know, doesn't that strike you as strange? Here they managed to catch a woman in the very act, and she was the only one they could catch. Well, that sort of raises a question right there. This woman was taken in the act, and they brought her, but they didn't bring the man. Evidently, they were doing this to try to trap him. Perhaps they knew exactly where to go look, you see. Because what I think is interesting is they were going on with all this stuff, and what do you say? And we're told that Jesus just squatted down and he began to write in the dirt. We're not told what he wrote, but we're told the effect that it had. They all left. They sort of began to slink out from the eldest to the least. I can't prove what he wrote. I don't know. But I've just always suspected that maybe he wrote, a few names, dates, and places that they recognized. Sort of took the wind out of their sails, whatever he wrote. They didn't have anything left to say. I think when he called them an evil and adulterous generation, I don't think he was just exaggerating or slinging epithets. I think that's what they were. And Christ knew that. For all of their pretense and all of how good they were, they weren't what they cracked themselves up to be at all. So he was very plain. When the disciples had come to the other side, see, they were crossing here in the boat, they had forgotten to bring any food, didn't bring any bread. And Jesus said, they must have been talking about it, and Jesus said, well, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They totally missed the point. They got to thinking, well, must be we didn't bring any bread. He doesn't want us to get bread from those guys. And Jesus said, what are you talking about? Why are you reasoning among yourselves because you brought no bread? Verse 9, don't you understand? Don't you remember the 5 loaves or the 5,000? How many baskets you took up? Don't you remember the 7 loaves or the 4,000? How many baskets you took up? Don't you understand? I'm not talking about bread. When I say don't beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees, then they understood that he was not talking about the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. See, that's what he meant. You know, what they have to offer. One place we're told that the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. So it's Christ emphasized that as they crossed over. Then, verse 13, Jesus came into the coast of Caesarea Philippi. Now, this is what I mentioned earlier, you know, this great cliff there on the sort of dominating the landscape. And so he brought up a question. He said, "Whom do men say that I am?" And they said, "Oh, well, you know, a lot of people have different opinions. Some people think you're John the Baptist, and somebody thinks you're Elijah, and somebody else thinks you're Jeremiah, or one of the prophets come back to life." And he said, "Well, who do you think I am?" And Peter answered, we read John's account of this earlier. Peter answered and he says, "You're the Christ, you're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. We know who you are." And Jesus said, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona. Flesh and blood hasn't revealed this to you. You didn't get that from just listening to what people on the street were saying. My Father in heaven revealed that to you. You understand that not because of what the rumors say, but you understand that because God has opened it." He said, "I say unto you, you're Peter, you're Petros. Upon this rock, Petra, I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." The gates of Hades, of the grave. Now, you know, the Catholics try to take this and say, well, he built the church on Peter. Peter's the first pope, and that was what that was all about. Well, Christ didn't build the church based on any one human being. We're told that the apostles and the prophets collectively are the foundation. The prophets and the apostles wrote the Bible, didn't they? The prophets wrote the Old Testament, the apostles wrote the New Testament. So the Bible is the foundation, and Jesus Christ is the chief cornerstone. He's the big rock. He's the one from which everything else takes shape and definition. Peter evidenced by this certain rock-like qualities. The Christ nicknamed him Peter, nicknamed him a name that meant rock. And Peter evidenced certain qualities like that, and even not only in personality, but even certain spiritual qualities along that line. So Christ, but Christ built the church upon himself. And it's not going to be swallowed up. It's not going to cease to exist. He says, "I will give unto you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatsoever you shall bind on earth, you shall be bound in heaven. And whatsoever you shall loose on earth, shall be loosed in heaven." Now, this is the this expression in terms of binding and loosing. You go through and you find that. Well, let's just come on over, just briefly look in Matthew 18. Let's see what this is talking about. Matthew 18:15. "If your brother trespass against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you've gained a brother. If he won't listen, take one or two more, that in the mouth of two or three witnesses the words may be established. If he neglects to hear them, tell it to the church. And if he neglects to hear the church, let him be as a heathen and a publican. Truly I say unto you, whatsoever you shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatsoever you shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Again, I say unto you that if two of you agree on earth as touching anything that they shall ask, it will be done of them. Two or three are gathered in my name, I'm in the midst." Now, in the context here, Matthew 18 amplifies what you find in Matthew 16. It was not just that Peter only. It was in the context of the disciples, the church, taking it to the church, meant clearly to those in authority in the church, those who had the authority to make binding and loosing decisions. And the term binding and loosing was a common term among the Jews. It referred to official decisions made in the the rabbinical courts. Matters came up and a decision to in terms of a judgment which involved how to apply certain principles, binding and loosing, giving permission or forbidding. That was the sense of it. And so Christ is here conveying to Peter, but not only to Peter, to the others, and he talked about that things of importance like that would normally involve at least two or three of them gathered in his name, that is, by his authority. It's not just everybody sort of charging off doing his own thing. But Christ was giving certain authority to those whom he had chosen to make judgments and decisions. Continuing on Matthew 16, he told his disciples not to be going around telling everybody that he was the Messiah. Verse 21, from that time forth he began to show unto his disciples how he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests, be killed and rise again. And Peter, far from having been made the infallible pope, Peter called him off and said, "Now wait a minute, Lord, all this stuff about you going down there and being killed, we're not going to let that happen. This will not be done to you. I'll take care of you, and boy, I got my sword right here, and we'll just attend to any of that." And Christ looked at him and he says, "Get you behind me, Satan. You're an offense to me. You don't understand the things of God, but the things of men." He really, dressed him down pretty sharply. Peter hadn't just become the infallible pope. Peter didn't understand. See, Peter had some lessons to learn. And Christ then said, "If any man will come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Whoever will save his life shall lose it. Whoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. What is a man profited if he gains the whole world and lose his own soul? The Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels. Then he shall reward every man according to his works." Now here's a plain scripture, by the way. When do you receive your reward? Is it when you die and float off to heaven? No. The Son of Man comes in the glory of his Father with the angels. That hadn't happened yet. That's when he shall reward every man according to his works. The reward is given by Christ at his coming. Then he said, "Some of you standing here won't die until you see the Son of Man coming in the kingdom." What does that mean? Well, just check. Remember the chapter divisions are added in by men? Go to the very next verse. 6 days later, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, his brother, brought them up to a high mountain apart, and was transfigured before them. His face did shine as the sun, and his raiment as white as the light. And there appeared Moses and Elijah talking with him. And Peter said, "Well, Lord, it's good for us to be here. Why don't we just go ahead and make three tabernacles?" Now, I think the time setting, and even some of the commentaries recognize this, is probably just right around the fall festival time, right before the Feast of Tabernacles, when it was normal, the practice to build tabernacles, sukkahs. And Peter said, "Why don't we just go ahead and celebrate right here? We'll just go ahead and build tabernacles, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah." Now, when you read the parallel accounts, I think it's sort of a funny statement. Mark 9 is a parallel. Verse 5, Peter said, "Master, it's good for us to be here. Let's make three tabernacles." Verse 6, "For he didn't know what to say, for they were sore afraid." Now, some people, when they don't know what to say, they just keep their mouth shut. Peter was not one of those people. When, he was scared and he couldn't think of anything to say, so he said that. That was why he said it, because he just couldn't think of anything else to say. Well, sometimes, if you can't think of anything to say, sometimes it's a good idea just not to say anything. They saw this tremendous miracle. Peter talks about it back in 2 Peter, the last book that he ever wrote. He hearkened back to that and talked about, "We were with him in the Holy Mount. We heard the voice from heaven. We saw this," speaking of him and John, because John's brother James was the first of the 12 to die, and had died much earlier. So anyway, this voice from heaven, cloud, bright cloud overshadowed them. Matthew 17:5 said, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Hear you him." The disciples fell on their face. They were so afraid. Just scared them. You can imagine what an overwhelming thing this would be. You see, they actually saw him coming in the kingdom. That's the fulfillment of it. They saw Christ. They saw him transfigured, his face radiating power and glory. They saw Moses and Elijah. They saw, it was like they were transported in vision, and they saw the kingdom. Well, they fell on their face. Jesus touched them, and when they lifted up their eyes, verse 8, they didn't see anybody except him. Now, what they had was a vision. We're told that in verse 9. As they came down from the mountain, Jesus charged them, saying, "Tell the vision to no man till the Son of Man be risen from the dead." Well, this sort of provoked the question. The disciples said, "Well, Lord, what do the scribes mean when they say that Elijah must first come?" You know, because they just seen this, and Elijah was there in the vision. How did they know it was Moses and Elijah? You ever wondered that? I think it was just part of the vision. You know, they just sensed it. They just knew they were having a vision, and perhaps they heard him address them by name. But I think even more likely, they were having this vision, and they just, it was like they knew who that was, because you wouldn't recognize somebody like that. That they'd been dead for centuries, but. It sort of brought the question to mind. They said, "Well, what's that about Elijah must first come?" And Jesus said, "Well, Elijah truly shall come, first come and restore all things. I say unto you, Elijah is come already, and they knew him not." They've done whatever they wanted. "Likewise, the Son of Man shall suffer." Well, then the disciples understood that he spoke to them about John the Baptist. That's who he was talking. That's who was the Elijah. Now, John the Baptist clearly fulfilled that role in the first coming. You know, there's some people who've made this great issue. It's like their whole doctrine is, do you believe Mr. Armstrong was the Elijah? You go all the way through the book of Acts. Now, we know who the Elijah was in the first coming. Very clear. Jesus said it was John the Baptist, so you don't have to wonder. You go all the way through the book of Acts. Every time somebody was ready to be baptized, do you ever find where they said, do you understand who the Elijah was? The question was, do you understand who the Messiah was? That was the emphasis. Yes, the Elijah had come, but that wasn't the emphasis. When Peter and Paul and all the rest of them were preaching, that wasn't their focus. John the Baptist didn't come putting focus on himself. He came putting the focus on Jesus Christ. The purpose of John as the Elijah was to point out Jesus Christ. John was not to be the focus of attention. He didn't focus attention on himself. In fact, a remarkable man when you think of his humility. You remember what he told his disciples? He pointed them toward Jesus. And he said, he must increase and I must decrease. No hint of resentment or jealousy or competition. Remarkable in terms of an attitude that is pointed out. So, you know, I think that those who place their emphasis there have missed the whole point. And when you look at the New Testament, that's not the place for the emphasis. The emphasis is on Jesus Christ. Anyway, verse 14, when they were come to the multitude, there came to him a certain man kneeling down and said, "Lord, have mercy on my son. He's sore vexed, sometimes falls in the fire, sometimes into water. I brought him to your disciples and they couldn't cure him." And Jesus said, "O faithless and perverse generation, how long will I be with you? Bring him here." Jesus rebuked the demon. He departed out. The child was cured from that very hour. And the disciples said, when he got Jesus apart, why couldn't we do that? You know, why couldn't we cast him out? Christ had given them authority earlier. Jesus said unto them, "Because of your unbelief, truly I say unto you, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, you'll say to this mountain, remove to yonder, and it'll remove." So, this kind, verse 21, goes not out but by prayer and fasting. So, that was an important key. And so while they abode in Galilee, this is where they were remaining, Jesus said, the Son of Man shall be betrayed into the hands of men, and they'll kill him, and the third day he'll rise again. And let's just notice one thing. Let's notice in Mark's account, just one Mark's account, Mark 9, the Mark 9:19, Jesus said, faithless generation, how long will I be with you? How long will I suffer you? Bring him to me. It's a parallel account of what we just read. And as you come on down, the verse 27, Jesus took him by the hand, lifted him up, he arose. When he was come forth into the house, the disciples asked him privately, why couldn't we do it? And he says, this kind comes forth by nothing but by prayer and fasting. Clearly, prayer and fasting is a vital key to growing in faith. You know, Christ, when you look at Matthew's account, Christ emphasized, because of your unbelief, you lacked faith. And then he talked about prayer and fasting. You see, prayer and fasting is a key to building faith. And that's something that is a vital aspect of growing in our relationship with God. Now, these accounts bring us up to just as we were ready to pick up, we saw there in John chapter 7, right up there to the time just before the Feast of Tabernacles. And that's where we'll pick it up next time and go from the period of the Feast of Tabernacles on up through the next few months of Jesus' life that we'll see. So I've got study questions to pass out on that part this evening.